This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I do need to come in for just a few minutes tomorrow. I'm splitting my time between two different projects, and one of the projects has been a bit neglected, so I need to come in and just put in a little time on that. But everything is puttering along. It's going along good. We had our hard cut over on one of our projects this week, and that all seemed to go fine. And so we're in the process of working out the final permissions on that. And that project actually, theoretically, is supposed to be getting finished up this next week. And I think we're going to make that. So that's good. I think we're coming in on there on budget or a little under budget, which is good. And there may be some suggestions that will come along that will fill up the rest of the budget. But we'll see how it goes. So anyways, so that's good. Through all the major stuff, I think, with that project now. And it goes well. The other project, we're getting close to the end of it, and then I wasn't sure what came next after that, but some of my colleagues are talking to me already about at least one other additional thing behind that, so there may be work for a few more days. Woohoo! It's been a good week on the conversation front. Had a lot of good conversations this week. Friends. I love having good friends. I love that. It's good. It's good. We have had a little excitement this week. Been able to be a help to a particular person that was really needing some help. And, you know, it was interesting because this particular person is not the type of person who likes to have to be relying on other people, but we were in the right place, the right time, and were able to offer some assistance. And, you know, I could tell that there was some discomfort with having to accept the assistance because they didn't want to be a bother, and I got a chance to be able to say, okay, look, in 50,000 years, the only thing that's going to be important is the things that we've done in kindness and love and generosity and mercy, the things that we've done in relationship. That's what's going to be important. And what we're doing here are things that we will be able to talk about 50,000 years from now. And remember and say, it's good that we did that. So I just don't get all stressed about this. We're fine. Everything's fine. I happen to be a computer consultant. My schedule is flexible. The time I'm spending doing this is time well spent. So it's good. So that's been good. The writing is going well. It's really been fascinating to watch the effect that not doing the improvisational comedy has had on my writing. Because I just was not... Excuse me. Having a little yell there. I really didn't recognize how much the improvisational comedy was distracting me. I mean, I've been struggling for really the last 8 or 9 weeks with the book. I've been making some progress, but I was just slogging through it. And once we got past our little performance last week, well, a week ago, and then I had a few other things to take care of. You know, it started opening up again. But then over the weekend, it really started opening up. And I think I've got the map now to move on out. There's still a few things to be worked out. But I think I'm in pretty good shape to get this book finished up. And so this weekend, I'm really hoping to make a serious dent in the major, major chapter. I'm almost all the way up to the edge of it now, the darkness. But I should be into that chapter before the weekend is through, and I think that's going good. So now it's just, just gotta make it all work, you know? I've made people cry in the first book and in the second book. I gotta make people cry in the third book. Because, you know, that's what they're gonna expect. So we'll see. But it's gonna be fun. It's gonna be fun. I think it's gonna be fun. Anyways, and then it's on to the last book, and then it's deciding what comes next.
Excuse me.
In the series. It's been good. Anyways, I had mentioned that a buddy had recommended to me the book The Power of Habit, which is a very good book. And in fact, I had mentioned in previous podcasts that the book was the basis for an article that I've already done a podcast on concerning how Target determines what coupons to send you and how they can figure out whether or not you're pregnant and why they would want to issue, you know, figure out if you're pregnant.
Because,
wow, I am so sorry. I did get plenty of sleep last night. It was a long day. We got a lot done today. But this book, The Power of Habit, is really goes into much more detail in a lot of different areas about habit. And I've talked to my friends about this over the course of the last couple of weeks. I've been talking about this. And so a lot of this sounds very familiar to me, and I'm really, really hoping that I haven't already talked about this on previous podcasts. I don't think I have. If I do, I apologize in advance. The book starts out by talking about structurally what is happening in the brain with what we call habits. And it's a very interesting thing, and it's a critically important subsystem. And it's like really, really great that we have this subsystem of being able to form habits. Because as the researchers have been doing investigations into how the brain works, how the brain learns, they came across something fairly surprising, and I really have in the back of my mind that I've talked about this before, but let's go through it again. One of the early studies where the researchers went, oh, what's going on there? Was that they attached electrodes to rats' brains. And then they put the rats in a fairly simple maze. It was simply a T maze because it was shaped like a T. The rat would start on the upright of the T, down at the base of it. There would be a sliding door. And then they would put chocolate at one end of one of the cross beams, the cross of the T. So it would be either on the right side or the left side. And it would always be there, so the rat could actually learn, or mouse, where the chocolate was. And they would always have a loud click just before they opened the door. So they could have a cue, and then the rat would have some sort of response. And then if they turned the right way, they would get the reward, which was the chocolate, at the end of this fairly simple maze. As they monitored the brain activity, they saw what they expected initially, and that was as soon as the click went off, there was a lot of brain activity. And initially, what the mouse was doing was sort of bobbing back and forth, bobbing back and forth, bobbing back and forth. And then eventually finding the junction of the T, bobbing back and forth, running to one end and discovering the chocolate. Woohoo! Reward! Ta-da! Okay. What they weren't expecting is after they did this a couple of times, that the neurological activity they were measuring in the higher centers of the brain actually decreased after the click. There would be a click and it would be like, whoo, time to go. And then the neurological activity in the brain would drop. And then the only time it would spike again was when the rat or the mouse hit the chocolate. But in between, it was like the higher centers of the brain weren't doing much. Why? Because the habit was taking over. And the habit is driven by this very small region of the brain called the basal ganglia, I think. And that all these habits get encoded in this very small region of the brain, which is pretty interesting and in fact vitally important. I mean, I'm driving home, hence the title of this podcast. I'm not really thinking much about driving because I'm talking at the same time. Now, I'm looking, there's a truck in front of me, there's a truck behind me, Ford in front, Chevy behind. They're fairly close. I'm tracking their distances. I'm weaving through the road because the road is not perfectly straight, so I'm compensating. I'm constantly compensating for where the car is in between those lines. I'm also very aware of the fact that cars, it's a little two-lane state highway, so I have cars that are coming by me from the other direction. I'm tracking where they are, determining whether they're swerving into my lane. I'm paying attention. For instance, I'm coming up to a stoplight or a stop sign and a flashing red. And so I'm slowing down because I know I'm supposed to slow down here. But when I'm doing a normal podcast, I don't even think about those things. And in fact, if you took readings on my brain, you would see that the higher reasoning centers of my brain, not even working. Why? Because I've driven this road a lot of times in the past 19 years almost, this June. It'll be 19 years, and in fact, when we were building the house, it's been over 20 years that I've made this drive. And this is a habit. Driving is a habit. I don't have to think that hard about it, which is really cool, because that means I can do other things. Now, obviously, I need to pay a little bit of attention so I don't run off the road or run into somebody that's critically important. But I don't have to give it my entire attention because it's a habit. And the basal ganglia just takes over for a lot of that processing power that would normally be dedicated to doing this. And that is very, very cool. There is another story in the book that kind of shows the power of habit as well and the power of this mechanism. They were talking about a guy who had gotten, I don't know, it was some kind of meningitis or something as an adult, and it turned into this rare form that started eating his brain tissue, and he almost died, and the doctor said, you know, we can put him on powerful antiviral medicines, and we might be able to keep him alive, and the wife said, yes, let's do it, and they got it stopped, but it had destroyed his ability to make new memories. And of course, then they wanted to study him, and he still had his personality, he still had his old memories, he could still make conversations, but he couldn't remember anything that had just happened to him. And so he would tend to repeat the same things over and over and ask the same questions over and over. And they had moved this guy to, his wife had moved him to a house that was closer. Of course, he wasn't in this house when he had the capability to make memories. So it's not so good. His wife has to pay really close attention. And yet he's in this house for a while. And they come and visit him in this house. And they do things like tell him, So do you know where the kitchen is? And he looks around and he says, No, I don't really know where the kitchen is. And yet, when they talk to him about getting hungry, yeah, I kind of am getting hungry. Maybe I'll go get myself a snack. He stands up, walks into the kitchen, opens the cabinet, gets out the jar of peanuts, has a snack. But he can't tell you where the kitchen is in the house because what's doing all that is his basal ganglia. It's another subsystem that's kicking in. Really cool stuff. And I'm going to have to start cutting this short, but that ability to form habits, they showed that that actually gave him a rudimentary ability to learn stuff. His wife would take him out for a walk, you know, every morning. And the doctors told him, well, don't let him get away from you because he'll have no idea where he is. And one morning, she was doing something, took a little longer for her to get ready to go for a walk. He took off on his walk. She's frantic. They're looking everywhere for him. Searching. They come back to the house. He's back home. Why? Because he got out, walked around the block, had no idea which house was his, but when he got to his house, the basal ganglia kicks in and says, turn here, and he turns there, and he walks into his house and sits down. He doesn't know that's his house, but the habit tells him where to go. Really fascinating stuff. And a really wonderful subsystem to have. I had an interesting experience with habit a couple of weeks ago when I had my little episode with the silent migraine that I told you about last week. Because there was one spot when I was trying to do some documentation and I couldn't remember how the word stuff was spelled. And then when I'd think, how is that? I don't know how it's spelled. But then when I just relax and just let my fingers type it, my fingers would type it. You know, at one point I was trying to take a whole block of text and comment it. Well, that's Control K, Control C. I've done that a gajillion times. I couldn't remember what the combination was when I was in the middle of that. It only lasted about an hour, you know, silent migraine. But I thought to myself, having read this book, just relax. Let your fingers just do it. And so I thought, I need to comment this block, and I just let my fingers go. Control C, Control K, or Control K, Control C, bang, bang. It just takes care of it. And I was able to actually work for that hour and get some work done because I could just relax and let the habitual processes that I do in programming over and over and over take over and actually carry me while I was having this migraine storm in my conscious mind. It's fascinating, fascinating stuff that we can do very complicated tasks that have been coded into the basal ganglia. Okay, so having said all that, then there is a lot of interesting information in the book that's just kind of little tidbits that are pretty fascinating. One of them, and I think I mentioned this when I did the thing on Target, that you can't really extinguish a bad habit, that what you have to do is you can change it. You can kind of keep the same cues, but you can change the reward and you can change the response to it and you can restructure that habit. That's a very interesting thing. And he actually has several steps. I'm getting my mail, one moment. And this is the season when there's wasps in the mailbox, which is very exciting. Hey, there he goes. Okay, so let me get my mail here, and hopefully no more wasps will fly up from below. Just going to check here real quick and see what we've got for mail. Okay, good. And he has a whole series of steps about how to look at habits, how to work with your existing habits. One of them is identify the routine. You know, check and see, oh yeah, I am getting this cue, and then I always do that, and it's not necessarily the greatest thing for me to do, but I'm just in a habit of doing it. Well, if you can identify that routine that comes out of the response, then that's the first step. And then you can start experimenting with rewards. Do I really think this routine is over if I go and talk to a friend as opposed to getting myself a cookie? And we talked about a little bit about that. Want to isolate the cue? Really, really figure out what's setting this off. You know, is it time? Is it hunger? Is it a desire for fellowship? And then get a plan together. How am I going to confront this thing and recognize that it's happening so that I can deal with it better? Really interesting stuff. One of the other interesting things that they said that was necessary, if you're trying to go up against habits that are ingrained and you're trying to do something about it and you're trying to change, they said you can understand all the mechanisms of what's happening with those habits and you can understand how to change them, but there's one core thing that you need to actually get it changed, and that's belief. And they started talking about, the author was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and how that one of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous does that helps people break the habit of alcoholism is that, first of all, it introduces the idea of a higher power to give people a belief that they can change. Their higher power can help them change. But then in addition to that, they're sitting in a circle looking at people who have gone 10 days, 30 days, 2 years, 5 years without taking a drink. And it allows them to say, you know what, if they can do it, I can do it. It allows them to actually have the belief that they can change, that no matter how deeply ingrained the habit is, they can have the belief that something different can happen. The other thing that I found very interesting in the book was the concept of keystone habits and how important keystone habits are. That you don't have to change everything all at once. What you just need is something that can be a focal point for you to say, I'm going to change this. And it works the same whether it's individuals or whether it's corporations. There's a big, long section where he talks about Alcoa, which is the aluminum company, the big aluminum company, that had fallen on some hard times. There were some troubling signs on the horizon. They had hired a new CEO, and the CEO gets up and he doesn't talk about the bottom line and how they're going to slim down their operations and how they're going to save money and how they're going to, you know, be able to improve their profit margins. He doesn't talk about any of that stuff. What he talks about is, we're going to fix the safety issues that we have. We're going to make our plants better places for people to work. And our number one priority is going to be worker safety. And everybody looked and went, oh man, we're in trouble. The stock drops. People are bailing, selling stock because they're saying, this guy is nuts. Why is he focusing on worker safety? And yet, that effort, that intense focus that he brought to Alcoa to change the fundamental habit of treating workers like they were dispensable, to begin a new way of thinking of treating workers like they were indispensable and they were important, revolutionized the company, because it was a keystone habit, and it was a keystone habit that, in my vernacular, was fully and firmly grounded in spirit, that people are important, that people should be valued, and that we should make good conditions for our workers to work in. And that led to a lot of unexpected things. Like, if you're going to have a safe plant, workers have to be able to communicate with their bosses, and bosses should listen to them. And so that increased the workers' sense of value. And I think what he said in the book, I don't have it in my notes, but I think what he said in the book is that if you had invested $1 million in Alcoa stock on the day when this new CEO, his name was Paul O'Neill, took over, that 5 years, 10 years, 15 years later, some time period, I don't know, you would have made $1 million back in dividends. Maybe it was 15 or 10 years. And your stock would have been worth like five times as much. It was just unbelievable how well the company did. Because they found a keystone habit that, again, in my vernacular, was founded firmly in spirit. And the exercising of that keystone habit strengthened the spirit of the company and of the individuals. And as soon as they did that, everything got better across the board. I got to tell you, in reading this book, one of the things in reading about Starbucks, I'm not a big coffee guy, but in reading about Starbucks, and how they go about training their people, I'm thinking, wow, I hope my granddaughter goes to work for Starbucks, because they actually train their employees how to regulate their emotions and how to marshal their self-discipline. This is part of their focus. Because if they can do that, they can deal with the irate customers, they can deal with the long lines, the frantic work conditions, and they can keep an attitude of pleasantness and give people a little bit of joy, because that Starbucks isn't just about selling you coffee. They're about selling you coffee with a little bit of a pleasant encounter with somebody. And they actually have all these techniques that they train their people in over and over and over to get it down to the point that it's habitual and their people just do it. And they had one called the latte method. And that is, when there's a problem, we use the latte method. We listen to the customer. We acknowledge their complaint, A. We take action, T, by solving the problem. We thank them for bringing it to our attention, and then we explain why the problem occurred, and then we go on. And it's, you know, wow, to get that type of training, that's really valuable, because you can use that everywhere. Again, it's the keystone habits. If you can take that training and get it down to where it's just habitual, that really can pay benefits. Anyway, so it was a very interesting book, and there were some other stuff that, you know, I could chat about, but I'm already long on this podcast, so I should probably wrap it up. There was one other thing that I wanted to talk about when I was talking about the latte method, and with habits and habitual and get it down. Oh, I know what it was. When I was chatting with my friend last night, and we were talking about approaches to life, and I was talking about with them about the fact, they were asking me, you know, well, what do you eat? You know, how do you go about, because this particular friend wanted to lose some weight, and, you know, how do you go about disciplining yourself? And I said, well, honestly, what I had to do in the early days was expend a lot of emotional energy and mental energy to getting myself doing these things, getting up and doing some form of exercising in the morning, go for a walk, go for a run, coming home in the evening, doing some form of exercise, eating sensibly, fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, lean meats, staying away from sugar, all of those things required some effort initially. But the great thing about it is as you do them over and over and over again, it becomes habitual. And if you stress to yourself the reason that you're doing these things, that there's a good reason for it, I am doing exercise every day so that my body can function better, so that I can lock in higher glucose levels in my brain, so that I can keep my weight down and keep down the stress on my knees and my hips and my ankles, so that I can be healthier and reduce the chances of heart attacks and strokes and developing adult onset diseases like type 2 diabetes, etc., etc., etc. There's reasons why I'm doing this, stressing that to myself. Back years ago, when we had moved in out here in the country and I was going out and running, it was a struggle, a fight for those first many, many months. And it was hard. I remember the first day that I got out and went for a run. I could maybe a tenth of a mile I made it for. And then I was just, everything was hurting and I had to walk. And I walked for a little while and run some more. And the only thing that kept me going through a lot of that is every day when I would get up and walk out there, I would tell myself, this is the best half hour you are going to spend all day. This is it. This is the best half hour you're going to spend. And after telling myself that for month after month after month, it finally started getting ingrained to where it was a habit. And then I started reaping some of the benefits, getting some of the rewards. And now, having done it year after year after year, I get up in the morning. It's morning. That's the cue. Ding, ding. Get dressed. Get on your shoes. One of the first things I do. Roll out of bed. Do my morning oblations in the bathroom. Come out. Get changed. Go for a walk. Soon, when it gets just a little warmer, start going for a run. Because that's the first thing I do. It's habit. And habit is a marvelous engine. If you can use it for your benefit, and it can be just as destructive as an engine if you allow your flesh to use it for your detriment. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.